shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico. It's the Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN with your guide, Dave Hoekstra.
Welcome back. It's been a long, just when I was getting the hang of this show, Dan Long, we're off for 3 or 4 weeks, and we're back. We're back with a fun show tonight. We're gonna talk about some of the things I went through the last few weeks. We're going to have Women with Beer. We're going to have Charlie McCoy talking about Bob Dylan and Nashville, things like that. And we're going to begin with a story I learned about in 1993, in July of 93, at one of our spiritual sponsors, the Golden Apple Diner up on the north side. And Marie Williams, the late Marie Williams, she was a second shift waitress there. And we have in the studio Flo Costa, who's Marie's sister, and Gino DeLuca, who's a musician. We're going to talk about what he's doing with this story. But I learned over the years that, that Marie, besides loving Lefty Frizzell and Merle Haggard, we always talk about that, she was the second oldest of 23 children, right, Flo? Is that right?
That's correct.
And yeah. you're the youngest of 23 children. And over the years, there's all these efforts to have a family reunion, and I never thought I'd be piggybacking Wally Phillips, but I think the whole story really became known in May of 93, not too long before I met Marie, about they were in for to talk about the reunion with Wally and stuff. Can you pick up the story, Flo, from there?
Sure. Wally got involved because my sister and I were the last born of 23 children. Right from when our mother passed away on November 8th, 3 weeks after we were born. Because of that situation, our father being disabled, the kids eventually were split up. Marie tried to take care of them best she could. She had 4 kids. She was 22 years old. So how can you expect someone to take care of all these other kids?
Was she living in Uptown? I think somebody told me. Was she living in Uptown?
It was 1234 North Cleaver Street, the exact address. Okay. And she was living in the basement below our parents. So she could not take care of the kids any longer. She had to give them up. They eventually went to foster homes. Some were adopted. My sister and my twin and I were adopted, never knowing we had any brothers and sisters, period, until we were 34 years old, and I joined a group called Truth Seekers in Adoption, who helped me do a search, and eventually came across our first sibling, Karen. And from there, they were so excited we were back. No one thought we would find the family. Our records were sealed. They knew that they took us away from that home, never expecting to see us again. So when we came back, I think that gave everybody the drive to want to find others. And so that's when they contacted Wally. My sisters were all over the country, everywhere. Two of them in New York contacted a radio station out there, and they said, call Wally Phillips.
They said, call Wally Phillips.
The story started here in Chicago. They said, get a hold of Wally Phillips. He'll help you. And he did. There was 6 missing kids when we came to Wally, and 5 of them were found. And we finally found our last sister in May of this year.
That's why we're here.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That's exactly why we're here.
And how'd you find her, and what's going to happen going
forward? Actually,
and
social media is wonderful, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted to set up a Facebook page to help find Frances. She was our last sister, our last sibling not found. So I didn't know quite how to go about that. I got a hold of my sister Betty, because I knew she was brilliant with that stuff. Asked her if she wanted to go for that, and sure she did. She set it all up. Everything that I wanted her to do, she'd do. I'd tell her, put a song on there, and she did it, and blah, blah, blah. Well, my daughter had mentioned she saw an obituary a few years ago, thinking it was our sister Frances, because the birth date was almost exactly the same. It was one day apart, and everything was the same, the name except the middle. I told her I didn't think it was because of the birth date. Well, she put that obituary back up on that Facebook page, and my sister Betty saw it, and she said, I have to know if that's our sister. So she went over to a search group on Facebook called Search Angels, or Search Squad is the name of it, and I belonged to that group as well, so I went over there with her. She said to them, how do I find if this obituary is our sister Frances? Well, do you know within 15 minutes, the search squad knew it was not our sister Frances. And not only that, they also were able to tell us that our sister Frances had passed away in 1993, the same year Wally had our reunion. In March of 93 is when she passed away. Our reunion was in July.
July, okay.
But they also were able to tell us that they found pages for her husband and two children, who are is obviously our brother-in-law, niece, and nephew. So from there, we were able to contact them eventually, and they're thrilled. They are so happy that we are part of their life, and we are so happy they're part of ours. It's an amazing story that after 50, I think it's 56 years, our family split up, 56, 57, something like that. And finally, to find our last sibling. How awesome is that?
Do you want to? We found some Wally. Wally introducing the whole story. Can we play some of that, Dan? And you can hear. Just great to hear Wally's voice again.
Yeah.
Here's the very beginning of the story.
Want to hear a story that'll give you a glow? Listen, Barbara. Good morning.
Good morning, Wally.
Here's Barbara Gunderson. Probably in the annals of all the people who have populated our place in the passing parade, you won't get any testament from 60 Minutes. But you get one from me.
Okay.
Tell us this story, Barbara, about you and the gang.
Okay. Well, first of all, I come from a family of 23 children.
Wait a minute. Repeat that, please, for the West Coast. You come from a family of what?
23 children.
23 children.
That's right.
Can't hardly get that anymore.
God bless our mothers.
All right.
Anyhow, our mother died in November of 58. Very sad, and it was shortly after she'd given birth to the last set of twins. There were four sets.
Had this gone on in your family, but among predecessors, that many kids before?
I don't know a lot of our family history. I do know that some family members in the South that do have twins, but I'm not positive of which ones they were.
Well, I've never bumped into anybody who comes from a family of 23 kids, but how did you not get lost in the shuffle with that group?
Well, it's been difficult, but we've been searching and getting us all together over the years.
Did you all live in the same place at any one time?
Originally, I called the two groups of children, the first group and the second group, the first group being in the South. The second group that was born to our mother was in the Chicago area, and we lived there, basically brought up in foster homes after our mother died.
I see. Well, that's a boy, what a tough assignment.
Yeah, really. So, anyhow, we were put into foster homes when our mother died, and we've lost touch with quite a few of them. Some of us have come back together, and we're having a reunion at our sister Sharon Miller's home in Muskegon, Michigan.
I happen to have a phone line open to Sharon Miller. She's a part of this 23-kid story, too, right?
Yes, yes, she's one of the next to the last set of twins.
Now, Sharon, how do you fit in with Barbara here?
Well, I met Barbara when I was about 23 years old.
But you had the same mom?
Yes, we did.
Did you know it before that time?
Yes, we did. My foster parents were up front with us, and they had told us we, had 23 kids in our family, and my twin and I'm also a twin.
Is that right? How many sets are involved in the 23 twins?
Four sets.
Four sets of twins?
Right.
Boy, what this woman has endured.
So there you go. Now, who were those, just again, reiterate, who the women were being interviewed there?
There was my sister Bobby Gunderson from New York and Sharon Miller at the time from Michigan, Muskegon, Michigan.
Okay. And you're talking about the reunion. Now you're going to talk about another reason you're here is a reunion next year. Would that be your mom's 100th birthday?
You betcha.
Okay, we're going to talk about that after a break, and we're also going to talk about the musical that's coming up, too.
Okay,
so don't go away.
Yep.
Bringing love into this world, it's often not your choice. Raising children in this world, how will they find their voice? The love of a mother at times misunderstood, with bad things, sad things surrounding. How can we find the good? Finding love in this world, how will it all work out? Find finding family in this world can fill your head with doubt. The love of a child, so often naive, but pure, yet so sure. My love is eternal. It's the presence of God. My gift to my family. On this earth it will trod to find one another. Will be your task to do. Just be kind, don't be blind. My love's always with you. Bring love into this world. It's your choice if you do. Allow your love into this world, and true love will find you too. The love of a mother, daughter, son, sister, and brother can compare to no other. Shouldn't or should, bringing love into this world is the greatest gift of all. Bringing love into this world is the greatest gift of all. Love you. We will always love you. I will always love you. Mama, we love you. One and
Gino DeLuca, thank you very much. Now, we got 2 minutes. We'll keep you on for after the news, but you wrote that. You're a cousin of Flo.
I did. I'm a cousin of Flo Costa.
And you're planning a musical.
I am. I've been out of touch with Flo for about 30 years, and when we reconnected, she said, "Are you sitting down? I've got a story for you." And I just found this story. Even though I'm not blood related to these people, I was just so touched by the courage of this woman to bring all this love into the world. And I've been in music my whole life, and
PhD in voice literature from the University of
Iowa.
Yeah.
We're gonna do the letters now. Yeah. They say that PhD stands for Perfect Hair DeLuca,
yeah.
but that's another thing. But yes, I was so inspired, and I love my cousin Flo so much. She put a guitar in my hand when I was 8. So that's, you know, and so I started writing a musical, and the finale number, it's basically just writing and recording itself. I want to celebrate this story. I want to share it with the world.
So you've learned about the family as you're writing this?
Oh, yeah. My cousin Flo has sent me many emails. I actually put them in a Word file, which is actually bigger than my dissertation. not that we're competing here. It was always a competition, wasn't it? No, I'm kidding. But this is my cousin Bobo. We used to call her Bobo because we couldn't say Flo. This is Bobo's dissertation. This is her story. This is her family story. And I'm so honored to have been exposed to this and to be a part of this and to help celebrate it.
Now you can hang around a little bit for the next segment. You can play another song, and I want to talk about
it. Oh, you may have to twist my arm, but yeah, I think I'll stay.
Okay, we'll be back after the news on Nocturnal Journal. Don't go away.
Gonna take a sentimental journey. Gonna set my heart at ease. Gonna take a sentimental journey. To renew old memories. 7, that's the time we leave at 7. I'll be waiting up for heaven, counting every mile of railroad track that takes me back. Never thought my heart could be so yearning. Why did I decide to roam? Gonna take that sentimental journey home.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. That's Gino DeLuca, and I'm here with your cousin Flo Costa, and we've been joined by Dr. Neelam Agarwal, who's been on the show before, and we're going to talk a little about family bonding and the importance of family. Before we get to that, can you talk a little bit about the GoFundMe campaign for the reunion that'll be next year?
Yes, I can. Well, first of all, you know, with 23 kids, there's going to be a lot of family behind that. And we counted the grandkids alone last week. We're 70 grandkids. So we have tons of cousins, tons of grandkids, tons of relatives that have never met, because time is going by. Now, my older sisters, obviously, are getting up there in years as well as myself. It's hard for us to get together. And the last reunion we actually had was Wally Phillips. Since Wally Phillips' reunion, we've lost maybe 10 sisters, 10 siblings. And we'd like to have a family reunion so that we can at least meet Francis and get all of our grandkids together in one place and all of our cousins and whatnot, and meet the brother-in-law that we should have met, you know, 30-something years ago in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. So we have set up a GoFundMe account in hopes that we will be able to get some help from the folks out there, because a lot of our family, being older, is on disability, Social Security. They have limited resources to make these trips, and it would really help us.
Where would this take place?
We're planning on Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, because that's where our brother-in-law Bob is from, Francis's husband, who we would really love to meet, at least all of us, you know, in one place. It would be like the world's largest reunion.
It would be, yeah.
That's what we're planning on anyway. But the GoFundMe account.
And we're also going to, there's a video we're going to put on the Nocturnal Journal Facebook page, which I very rarely talk about. But we will have the video on the Nocturnal Journal Facebook page up Monday or Tuesday that tells your family story. And we can link to the GoFundMe stuff on there, too.
Okay, but it is www.gofundme.com/or/. It works either way. ReuniteTheWilliams.com. So okay. It's ReuniteTheWilliams, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S. And we really appreciate any help that we can get from anybody that would like to help us. And you're invited, too, by the way.
What time of year will it be? Will it be in the summer?
Okay. My mother's birthday is June 4th. 2016, she would be 100 years old.
Uh-huh.
So that's the big part of the reason that we'd like to wait until next year to get together for our 100th birthday. We're going to celebrate it. We can't really do it on June 4th because kids are in school and whatnot, but we're planning from the 20th to the 25th, and we're going to celebrate her birthday on June 23rd for 23 kids to make up for that fourth that we're missing out on. But that's when we're planning.
Doctor, can you talk about just the importance of family bonding. And when we had you on before, we were talking about my mom having dementia. We talked dementia and music. And since then, my mom's passed away, and I lost both my parents within 6 weeks and stuff. And you just talk about family support and family caregiving. And
well, I mean, wow, what an amazing story I'm listening to here about a family that was split apart and now coming back. And in the breaks, I mentioned to Flo that what is the, you know, what are the strengths and the bonds even now? Because people being split apart, coming back, and the immense bonds that people have with family, and how important it is to have family together. And caregiving is the first thing that comes to my mind here, taking care of each other. I think even your song was perfect about what a mother brings in to this world, the love of that, the caregiving. I think family ties are really, really important, and they're very strong, and they're very complicated. And as people get older, especially, you know, when they're going through what I call the lifespan, things change. We all know that, but things change in your body, things change with your mind. And we've talked about, Dave, before with mom and dementia, you know, the changes in memory, the changes in being able to do things she used to do, it really, really now draws on the family. Can the family support that? Can support her? And this is where these caregiving ties, as I call caregiving ties, get stronger, or sometimes they really get stretched to the limit for many people.
You said June 4th. It was interesting, everything I went through. But on June 5th, the New York Times started a series. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fascinating. And I think it's an ongoing series called The Oldest Old. Yeah. And it's about all these people. And it's something that I've gone through, living to be past the age of 85. And I wanted to ask you about this. And they said in New York City, people 85 and over have grown five times as fast as the general population since 2000. Exactly. Are you seeing that around Chicago?
Absolutely. And it's not just New York City. It's a general trend. It's a national trend. The 85 and older age group is the fastest growing age group in the country. And here's the thing, you know, what we're seeing here, even in Chicago, we're seeing people transitioning and getting older, healthy aging. So it's not always when people think about, oh my goodness, so-and-so is old, he's getting, things are happening. We're seeing healthy agers, or super agers, as we call them, call this group of people who made it past 85, some up to 100, 102.
Yeah.
You know, I personally, you know, I had a patient who I saw was 102 years old. And I remember seeing this gentleman, and, you know, this is probably, we're going to talk a little bit more about this, but I always said to him after I saw him, I said, okay, now talk to me. How did you make it to 102? Tell me. I need to know this. And he said, he goes, here it is. It's my attitude. It's my attitude about life. It's my attitude about many things. And he thought about it himself. Why did I make it to 102? And, you know, he said, every day I get up in the morning, I get myself dressed, I get ready. For what? I don't know, but I'm ready.
Yeah,
okay,
right.
That was the first thing. The second thing, attitude of gratitude. The third thing he said, a sense of purpose. I'm here for something. I'm here to do something. And the last thing, I always laughed because this is really Southside, no stinking thinking.
Yeah.
No stinking thinking. And he said it so many times, and he really meant it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, that was my questions. Yeah. What are the aspirations? What are the dreams? I mean, both my parents, at the end, they both just said, you know, they wanted one more day. They wanted one more day.
Right, like, looking forward, right? Uh-huh. It's that looking forward still, I want something
to come
around.
Yeah. What about the changes? This is a common story that I hear a lot, and I don't know if you guys had it in your family, but when one spouse passes, the other goes fast.
Yeah.
I mean, what does abrupt change do to the oldest old? I mean, there was 6 weeks separation between my parents' death and
exactly.
stuff. How does that, people told us that was going to happen, and it did.
It's something to watch out for, clearly, okay? And it's not with everybody, but it's something to watch out for. It is a traumatic shock to many people, and here's the thing. A lot of times, you know, again, especially in cases where we've had long marriages with people, that everyone has assumed a role. We all had a role, okay? And especially when you think about your parents, they had a role for each other, support for each other, you know, they were there for each other. So when that role now is gone abruptly, that is where we worry, because now all of a sudden that role isn't there. I don't have to do that anymore. That person isn't there. And that's where the emotional hit comes in. And that's when it's now what's my role? What's my purpose? You see how it goes back to that? What am I doing now? And if you can't fill that void in, And if you can't find something to make that void say, well, no, this is the purpose, that's when people often decline. The other thing I do want to bring up when you do see these cases, and again, we have these families that come in. My mother died, just like what happened here with you, that window. Often the other spouse or the person has been ill with something.
Yeah, right.
Okay? And that illness was there, but that illness was somehow suppressed because they had a bigger sense of purpose. I'm here even though I'm ill. When that gets removed, the person has died, that illness can resurface, if you will, and kind of take over. And we do see that quite a bit. And that's, you know, that could have happened, I think, in your family's case. I'm trying to remember. With your father and your mother, tell me a little bit about the history.
Well, they both were very sick. I mean, my dad had, my dad ended up dying of lung cancer, but he had a lot of other problems that the oncologist told us. I think I told you that kicked that in. I mean, he had Parkinson's, he had diabetes, he had a bad heart. So he was sick. And then my mom had dementia, and she also, but she died of heart failure. And
right,
stuff.
Exactly.
But she was feisty. She was, we had breakfast the morning she died. You know,
really?
She declined really, really, really fast.
Wow.
Even though she wasn't all there. What about, and this is something I'm going through, what about like the survivors? And I was the primary family caregiver. Mm-hmm. My brother's in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's no right or wrong. Is there too much reflection, too much thought? Today I was looking at some paperwork and mm-hmm. I saw something my mom signed like 3 days before she passed away. It was about a trust thing. And it just mm-hmm. knocked me off my socks a little bit. Mm-hmm. And how does that grieving process go for anybody who's listening to this?
Well, you know, the grieving process is a very personal process. Some people, and again, people grieve very differently. I've seen that many times. And I, you know, again, to the people who are listening in the audience, please be aware people do grieve differently. So there may not be the tears, but there may be then the very quiet. Or there may be somebody being very loud and boisterous, and you're like, what is going on? People handle things differently. But what is interesting, and I think in your case, Dave, is that you were a son caregiver. More men are being put in the caregiving role now than they've ever had to. And I think, Flo, you and I talked about the women normally took care of a lot of these mm-hmm. things, right?
Yeah.
It was the women who stayed home who took care of these things. And I think with men, it's an interesting thing, and I'm noticing this. It's my men caregivers that come to me and ask me, what do I do? I don't know what to do, how to manage this. And then when somebody then passes, now what do I do? So I think we need to also, you know, be aware that men are struggling. I think in your case, you're going to have these moments that come up all of a sudden, and a lot of emotional. Little things can trigger.
Yeah, they do.
And that's okay. It's okay. It should come up. It should be expressed. You have to write it out.
We'll take a break, but the other day I drove by a Bob Evans, you know, and that was where they went for dinner. You know, and I go,
down
oh my
on
God,
the farm.
Bob Evans. And
down on the farm.
I got all bummed out at seeing Bob Evans. You want to do one more song out of the break when we come back?
I'd love to.
Okay, don't go away for more Nocturnal Journal.
Babba dabba 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 dabba, said the chimpy to the monk. Babba dabba 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 dabba, said the monkey to the chimp. All night long they chatter away, all day long they're happy and gay, swinging and singing in their honky-tonky way. Babba dabba 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 means monk I love but you. Babba dabba dabba in monkey talk means chimp I love you too. Then the big baboon one night in June, he married them, and very soon they went upon their abba dabba honeymoon. They went upon their abba dabba honeymoon. Yeah.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, and that's Gino De Luca. I didn't know this till you came into the studio. You do play senior citizens' homes, residents.
I do. I do a lot of work with the senior citizens, and like I said, most of my research is the Great American Songbook. And I find that music is indeed magic. I will sit down on the piano and I'll play songs from the 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, and people with mobility issues, people with memory issues. All gone. Yeah. It's like they were touched by a magic wand.
Exactly.
They start singing, they start dancing, and then the more lucid people will always come up to me and say, you took me back to the Pennsylvania Hotel 65,000 in 1940. I mean, they will remember the exact date exactly. that they heard. And what an honor to facilitate something like that and to be a part of that.
Yeah. It's about moments.
Oh, yeah.
Before we get out of here with this segment, I mean, moments. I mean, I thought about this when I read about what Scott Simon, when his mom passed away, how he was tweeting and bedside by tweeting. And I was bedside with both my parents when they passed away. And I just could never, I tried to be really present for that moment. I'm still trying to be present for every moment right now and not dwell too much on the past and not just try to embrace the moment. It's really being hard, difficult for me. Yeah. Can you talk about the moment?
Sure. And, you know, it's a really important topic. We got to talk about being in the moment. We are so divided with our attention all along. And I keep saying to people, it's a divided attention. Your brain is dividing different things. And you're not experiencing things as much as you can. And we have to now, frankly, it's come to a point where we have to train ourselves to be in the moment. Before, it just happened. You were in the moment. Now it's not. Now you have to be intentional. It is not only important to be in the moment and be intentional about it, it helps you focus, it helps you have clarity, it helps you think better. And again, I'm a neurologist by training, and I keep saying you have to have that I'm concentrating on the moment and taking it all in for what it is. And I agree with you, with your parents. Just being there, one of the biggest questions I get is when, especially when you have older parents getting sicker, let's say, or really getting into really bad health issues, what do I do? And sometimes I just say, be there. Just be there. And they're like, what? I said, no, sit with them. If it's TV we're watching, just watch TV. You're playing music, and what you're doing is you're helping people come in the moment. And you're in the moment with them, not thinking of the next thing, right?
It's wonderful. Yeah. And you have to let them just be themselves.
That's exactly it.
You allow them to be themselves.
Exactly. And you're with, you know, you're playing the music and you're singing the music with them, but you're in that moment with them.
Right.
That's enough.
I just found my moments to be so intense, I can't shake them. I mean,
good.
I go back to that moment a lot more than I think it's healthy. You know what I mean?
Well, but here again, you know, it becomes, frankly, unhealthy when it really brings the mood down and the sadness down, and you can't come up from that.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you have to feel that. You have got to feel those emotions because they have to come out. They have to be expressed in some way.
You're at the, I might have neglected this time around, but you're at Rush Alzheimer's Disease Center, at Rush University Medical Center. Mm-hmm. What's good resource material where people can find out more about this?
Well, there are a lot of resource materials, and I'm always big on the NIH, so the National Institute on Health and National Institute on Aging. You know, for tonight's segment, I had some materials I brought in, actually, about caring for people with Alzheimer's disease. These are materials that are free to people to order and to understand what it means to be a caregiver. They also have some other information on just how to keep yourself healthy. If you're a caregiver, you got to keep yourself healthy. If you don't keep yourself healthy as best as you can, you cannot take care of someone else. And so I think those resources are very good. Everything is online. Everything is downloadable. I really urge people to go to the National Institute on Aging, National Institute on Health, and learn more about this. I think, you know, before we started tonight's segment, Dave, I was talking in the back and stating everyone eventually is going to be a caregiver in some capacity. It's really going to, everyone will be. And the more you're aware and the more you're aware of what it may entail, what it may not entail, it's better for you, it's better for the person you'll be giving care to.
Yeah, sometimes it's not a sexy topic, but it's an important topic. You know what I mean? Gino, tell me the musical. We were talking about this. It was a good question for the doctor. Is it going to come near to Chicago?
You know,
what's the timetable?
First of all, I need to tell you the title.
Okay.
The title is called Circle of 23.
Oh, I didn't know that.
We
it's
are William.
Notes.
Well, it was Chloe, can you give me that? It was inspired by this circle that the oldest sibling made of all the circle of children around a loving mother. Mm-hmm. And like I said, this musical is writing itself.
Exactly.
I feel that I'm just facilitating it. And I've also come upon some poems that some of the siblings have written that I'm just kind of reshaping into musical lyrics.
But even, Gino, the symbolism of the circle, it's a circle of life.
It is.
Okay, I mean, just the circle is such a symbolic that was already done.
Here's the other symbol. The symbol of Alberta. I have her picture here.
Yeah, right.
Alberta Williams as an angel. Now, when I was coming home from my first trip with Flo, I saw an angel in the airport at this gallery, And I, like, when I sang the finale number a few numbers ago, I envision her coming back not as a dead person, but as an angel. And then all the siblings filing want to, you know, it's somewhere between Pippin and Les Miserables. And but all the other the symbols of angels that have that these siblings have referred to mom as, and just us not even knowing that. Mm-hmm. So right, so, the symbolism just running throughout. Sure, and I'm thinking of doing it more as a cabaret piece to begin with, like a story and a song and a story and a song. We definitely have enough information flow to flesh out into a full-length musical. So we'll see where it happens. We'll see what happens.
Well, thank you. I hope this was interesting to people and people learned something from tonight.
Oh, thank you. So, it's our pleasure. Thank you so much
for coming down on a rainy night. Gino DeLuca, Flo Costa, and Dr. Neelam Agarwal, neurologist at Rush Alzheimer's Disease Center at Rush University Medical Center. We're going to be back with Nocturnal Journey, and we're going to go to the Country Music Hall of Fame after the news. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal. And a few weeks ago, we took a little spin down to Nashville, the Country Music Hall of Fame, to see the Johnny Cash Bob Dylan exhibit and the Nashville Cats. The Nashville Cats were a group of session musicians who really came of age after Bob Dylan came down there in 1965 or so to do Blonde on Blonde, and they opened up the doors. Other people besides Dylan came down there: Neil Young, Paul McCartney, George Harrison got the pedal steel for All Things Must Pass with the Nashville Cats. So we tracked down Charlie McCoy, who was like the kind of the pseudo band leader, harmonica player, Big Little Walter fan, and we sat down with Charlie for a good deal of time at the Country Music Hall of Fame. And here's some of our little talk with the great Charlie McCoy.
Just tell me about your upbringing in, like, West Virginia and stuff. Music around the house, the roots questions.
Yeah, I was born in Fayette County, West Virginia, the same town Hank Williams died in.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a weird coincidence for you. I got my first harmonica when I was 8 years old. Saw an ad in a comic book, 50 cents in a box top for a harmonica. So I conned my mother out of 50 cents. Got a harmonica, and after about a day, she said, "Could you take that thing outside?" You know, that same year, I got a guitar for Christmas, and my folks were split. My dad lived in Florida, my mom in West Virginia, and I was kind of an anemic kid, and so they all figured out that the warmer weather in the winter would be better. Winters are hard in West Virginia. I don't need to tell you about hard winters. So. But anyway, so I was going to school in Florida, going back to West Virginia every summer. And when I went back to Florida, and when I was 8 years old, my dad was unpacking my suitcase and found the harmonica, and he started playing it. I had no idea he could play. And he played a couple songs on it. So anyway, I was all into sports, you know. I was played baseball and all that stuff. And so music was kind of, you know, it was something to do. It wasn't that big a thing. But when I was 15, I heard Bill Haley and the Comets, Carl Perkins, Elvis, and then I heard Chuck Berry, and I thought, hey, I have a guitar. I got to learn to do this. So I was really into that music. And then one night, late at night, I heard a station on the radio that played Jimmy Reed. And that
remember
was,
what station? Is this, do you remember what station that was?
Yeah, it was a station from Nashville.
WLAC.
Yeah, right. And it was so strange that, and I... My father didn't like R&B music, so I had a friend of mine's kid in our neighborhood. His dad was a ham operator, and he took my clock radio and put an earphone jack in the back of it, and I could listen late at night, and my dad wouldn't hear it, and listen to WLAC and hear Jimmy Reed, Howlin' Wolf, all the blues stuff, and then I discovered Little Walter, and that was it. He's still the greatest. For blues harmonica, it's still the greatest. So I was really heavy into harmonica again. In the meantime, I started singing. You know, we had a little band and nobody wanted to sing, and I kind of drew the short straw, so I started to sing. And I took a job with a country music dance doing rock and roll 10 minutes each hour. And one night when we were on stage, Mel Tillis came in and heard me. And I don't know, he probably had a couple beers. And he said, boy, if you come to Nashville, I'll get you on records tomorrow. Now, that was like showing a steak to a wolf. So the day after high school, I went to Nashville, and he wasn't here. But he told his manager about me, Jim Denny, who's also in the Hall of Fame. And without even hearing me, just on Mel's word, he set up auditions with Chet Atkins and Owen Bradley. And I went into Chet and Owen's offices and played Johnny Be Good. Well, they weren't too impressed. I mean, they both were really nice. They said, you know, you're really good, but, you know, we don't do that kind of music here. Well, okay. So I thought, well, okay, this is over before it began. And then Owen said to me, hey, you know, I'm having a session this afternoon. You want to come watch? I wasn't really sure what a session was, you know.
How old were you?
18.
18, okay.
So I went over to his studio, and I watched Brenda Lee record her first hit record. And when I watched that session and watched those musicians work, the first thing that struck me was, you know, when you're 18, everybody looks old. I thought, who are these old guys? Then she came in. She was 13. I said, she's just a kid. They're going to record a kid. And the other thing that struck me, there's no music. Nobody has any music. And they played a demo. You know, back in those days, all the demos were on a disc, acetate. They played a demo. It looked to me like the musicians weren't even paying attention. But when I heard the first playback, my gosh, that was some kind of magic, you know. And at that moment, I said, I don't want to sing. I want to do this. And that was it. I came back a year later to stay.
And that was 1960. 61, 60.
Did my first session May of 61 with an unknown Swedish singer named Ann Margaret.
Oh, I didn't.
And on that session, the bass player came to me and said, are you free Friday? I was free the rest of my life, you know. I said, yeah. And he said, come back to the studio. I'm recording Roy Orbison. And I was a huge fan of Roy Orbison. I said, yeah, Roy Orbison. So we did the record Candyman. After the record came out and got on the radio, my phone started to ring. It's like a charmed magic dream that I'm still in.
So now, this is good Chicago tie, too. You mentioned Little Walter. You mentioned listening to Jimmy Reed. That style of blues harmonica, did that separate you from other people in Nashville? I mean, did you create a certain style from listening to people like Little Walter in your formative years?
Well, in my formative years, I was trying to play as much like Little Walter as I could and Jimmy Reed. And for a while here, that was a novelty.
Right.
But then it started to wear a little thin. And I'd get comments like, could you play maybe not quite so funky, you know? You know, that nasty tone and all that stuff. And so I realized that if I'm going to stick around, I'm going to have to do something different. So I started copying fiddles, copying dobros, cleaning up the sound, and trying to play melodies. You know, that's one thing you don't hear many harmonica players do is play melodies. And that was what I was really trying to do. So I guess all that combination of all that stuff together gave me a sound.
We'll be back with more Charlie McCoy. He's going to talk about Blonde on Blonde with Bob Dylan after this break.
Lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big breast bed. Lay, lady, lay. Lay across my big breast bed.
Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal, and we were going to have an interview here with Charlie McCoy. He's going to talk about his work with Bob Dylan down in Nashville. And there's also a story in tomorrow's Chicago Tribune on our interview and also on the Nocturnal Journal Facebook page. Right, Dan Long? We're so proud of that. Anyway, here's more of Charlie and his work with Bob Dylan.
Now, I mean, one reason, obviously, we're here is the Dylan connection, and he always, you know, he's got such a deep affinity for the blues. When you met him, did he hear that in you? Tell me about your meet. I mean, I know this is stuff you've gotten a lot. I 65, you 64, 65, you were in New York.
Yeah.
Was it true you were at the World's Fair?
I was there to go to the World's Fair, and Bob Johnson had promised me Broadway tickets. So I got to New York and I called him. And I said, how about my Broadway tickets? He said, no problem. He said, hey, come over to Columbia Studios this afternoon. I'm recording Bob Dylan. I want you to meet him. So I went over there and he introduced me to Dylan. And he said, I'm going to do a song. Why don't you grab that guitar and play along? That was Desolation Row.
Long song.
Yeah, I'll say. Because there was nobody else playing fills but me. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I could love to have Grady Martin here. So later on, Bob Johnson confessed to me. He said, you know, I was using you for bait to get Dylan to come to Nashville.
And then what happened next? How did the bait work?
Well, he finally got him to come for Blonde on Blonde. And we had a group of Nashville players, plus Al Cooper and Robbie Robertson. And Dylan showed up. He was supposed to come at 2. We were booked at 2. His flight was late. He came about 6 and said, I haven't finished writing the first song. You guys hang loose. We started at 4 o'clock the next morning. Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, a 14-minute ballad. It was, and you're sitting there saying, please don't let me make a mistake. It was tough.
And where was this at? Which studio was this?
Columbia A.
Columbia A, okay.
Yeah. That was a studio that Columbia built because, you know, they had bought the studio from Owen Bradley, Columbia Records had. And they built Studio A because Studio B was booked around the clock. Well, nobody would use Studio A. Even they would wait till they could get a space in Studio B, the Quonset Hut. So Studio A was available to block book it for the whole week to record those artists like Dylan. So, you know, at the first, a lot of us musicians are thinking, this Studio A is a disaster. Why did they do this? And then later it became clear, this is going to become the home of some of these folk rock people.
I've actually interviewed him. We did a documentary about 10 years ago on the Staples Singers up in Chicago, and he is a musicologist. Did he know who the escorts were? Did he know of you guys? Did he know of you and Kenny?
He knew of one record I had.
He did?
Yeah. I know. Obscure, I think they've got it on the wall out there, called Harpoon Man. It was just a novelty thing we threw together. He knew about that record, but I don't know that he knew anything else. Somehow I didn't see him checking out the country charts.
His friendship with Cash moved that along, though. I mean, after he started being on the Johnny Cash shows and all that, which we see in there and stuff.
But it was a strange deal because he didn't talk. He never talked, and I was leader, so I'm supposed to be the go-between the artist, the producer, and the musicians. And every time I'd ask him what he thought about what we were going to do, his answer was, I don't know, what do you think? So I told Bob Johnson, I said, listen, I'm not getting any answers from him, so I'm going to quit asking. If he doesn't like something, maybe he'll speak up. He never said a word, ever. Maybe I should have been paid as producer, I don't know.
Were there cues or anything? He just didn't communicate.
He just sang the song, and we came up with an arrangement, you know, and it was all pretty straight-ahead stuff. There weren't many solos. If you listen to that record, there are not a lot of solos. A lot of the songs are real long, too.
Did you know what you were doing at the time in terms of, like, the revolutionary aspect of this today?
No.
Or was it just another session?
Just another session.
Really?
It was a strange session to us.
Uh-huh.
Number one, in the country world, nobody had the kind of budgets to have musicians sitting around all night in the country music because, you know, the audience, the buying audience was small, relatively small compared to pop music. And so the country labels were very careful with budgets, you know, that worked so they could get their money back. Like I said, to sit around, a whole room full of musicians sitting around for 7 or 8 hours, it was unheard of. Now, we didn't quite know what to think about all that, you know.
The thing I like about your guys' stuff, I was here for the Bakersfield thing, too, and I just like, of course, the lyrics and stuff, but one thing, right now, just going through this last hour, is your date book of March 1970, and you have Dylan written down. It was no bigger, I made notes of this, it was no bigger lettering than any Charlie Louvin or anybody else you were wearing. I think you had somebody scratched out. It really was just another session for you.
Well, we didn't, you know. To me, you know, even after Blonde on Blonde, to me, Dylan wasn't any more important than Johnny Cash or Dolly Parton or Don Gibson or Bill Anderson. You know, it was, they were all important to me. It's like, what do they say? The most important session of your life is the one you're getting ready to do. And it doesn't matter who it is. And that, I learned that from the A-team. They didn't care who they were working with. They went in there and they did their thing, their best thing for everybody they played for. And that was inspiring, you know.
You touched, this is one of my questions, and we touched on it early. A lot of your peers, a lot of other musicians, they listen to WLAC in terms of getting a wider sound? I mean, again, the blues feel. I know Charlie Daniels had a blues feel.
Yeah, no, most of the guys weren't aware of it.
They weren't?
No. A lot of the guys that came here, you know, their first thing, of course, was touring with some country band. That's where a lot of guys got their start. And then they'd work their way into playing on demos. And then, you know, like Fred Carter Jr., Billy Sanford, Pete Wade, all those guys were playing demos. And then, you know, as the great thing that what happened with this Dylan was that it exploded the town. It gave the A-team guys were already as full as they could get working. They couldn't do any more. And all of a sudden now here's this complete new volume of recording needs in town. And they can't physically do it. So there became a need for a whole lot more players and a lot more studios. And the studios started springing up right and left. And musicians are coming to town by the truckloads, you know. That, to me, that's a great thing that happened.
That's the great Charlie McCoy. I was looking at his website the other day, and last night he played the Hatfield-McCoy reunion in West Virginia. I don't know what goes down there, but we're going to have more of him next week. We're going to talk about the growth in the recording industry in Nashville, and we're also going to talk about his collaboration with Ween, which was a great record, songs like Japanese Cowboy and things like that. So they'll be on next week. We're going to be back after the news. We're going to talk about two of our favorite subjects, women and beer. So don't go away.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer.
Welcome back to the Nocturnal Journal, and we're going to start off here with talking about beer and something I don't know anything about, the Alpha 14 beer, help me, beer, not reunion, beer show. Anyway, it's Saturday, June 27th at Hudson Public House, 3801 North Ashland Avenue. Now tell me, we've got Chef Joe Hoke and Teresa Carter. Teresa's with Local Tourist, and you're with the beer.
Actually.
And when is Alpha?
So Alpha Beer takes place next Saturday night at A.J. Hudson's Public House, and we alphabetically drink through 26 beers, and our theme this time is women in beer.
Mm-hmm. So
not physically doused in it, but drinking it.
And so there's a different theme each time you do this?
Yes, actually we've done some local beers. Some of our initial ones, I don't think we did themes. We were doing, drinking through the alphabet is a theme enough.
Yes.
And how did you hook up with Local Tourist?
We met on Twitter.
Yeah, I was actually, I put out on Twitter that I was looking for somebody who might be interested in hosting one of the events. I'd already hosted a few of them, and Jill answered the call, and she's been our Alpha Beer Master ever since.
I think I've done 7 or 8 of them, and you've done 14.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And tell us what Local Tourist is.
The Local Tourist is an online guide for Chicago. We're also expanding to Milwaukee and San Diego, but it's a one-stop shop. We've got business directory, events calendar, a team of contributors that cover things that are happening in the city. So we just cover all the fun things to do in the city.
And there's a website.
Yeah, thelocaltourist.com.
Localtourist.com. Mm-hmm. And what exactly is Alpha Beer?
It's a structured beer tasting.
Okay.
So what we do is we find 26 beers. Each of them is affiliated with a letter of the alphabet from A through Z.
Okay.
And we could pick any part of the beer. We could pick the brewery name. We could pick the style of beer. We could pick the name of the beer.
Sometimes we pick the city.
For letters like X and Z and Y, we have a few challenges.
Yeah, Z, 1090 Brewing Company Zen.
Yes.
Where's that at? What's that about?
1090 is out of Zion.
Okay.
Yeah, so okay. And
so it's double Z. It's like ZZ Top.
Okay. Right. Yeah, okay. All right. Okay. And the backstory is your mother would drink a beer from a different letter of the alphabet with fellow commuters on a Friday night.
Yep, my mother would. Yeah. And every Friday night, and they decided that they wanted to try a lot of different beers instead of just doing the same, you know, beers that you could get at Union Station. So one week they would try A, the next week they'd try B. They did this for a year and a half. So they went through the alphabet three different times, had their own website. Binnie's would special order for them. I mean, they started off eating a six-pack, ended up needing 18. It's a half-hour ride, and everybody just, you know, the crowd grew. It was like, hey, this looks like a lot of fun. So I was telling a friend of mine about it. We happened to be at Twisted Spoke, which has one of the best beer lists in the city. And she said, you know what, you should make an event out of this. I said, you're right. So that's how Alpha Beer was born.
Now, I'm just curious, Teresa, where'd your mother live? I mean, how long a commute was it? You said about a half hour?
They were in Wheaton at the time.
Oh, in Wheaton?
Yeah.
That's not much of a beer town, is it?
No, it wasn't. Didn't live there very long. Yeah.
And what did she do? I'm just curious.
She's an accountant. She's a CPA and a certified internal auditor. So
okay.
CPA, CA.
Okay. Now, what will go on next Saturday night? How does this work? It's from 6 to 9, so what can people expect?
Absolutely. So they will come in and they will sit down. I go through a structured beer tasting. Telling people how to sip beer. We'll also talk a little bit about the different styles of beer, so a description between ales and lagers, the major styles of beer, and then we jump right in, because if you're going through 26 beers in 3 hours, you're thirsty, you're ready to rock and roll. So we start with the A beer, and we'll give a description of the beer. We talk about the alcohol by volume. We talk about the IBU, which is how bitter the beer is. And we also talk about tasting notes and things like food pairings. So beer is meant to be enjoyed with food, and we talk about optimal pairings.
Now, you brought some beer in with you. That's very nice of you. Thank you. We've got some here.
It's our job. Yeah. Yep.
We bring smiles everywhere we go.
So That's what gets us in the door sometimes.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I drink beer, but I just drink really just a couple brands. And I often get intimidated. I'll be sitting at the Matchbox or something, and, you know, somebody like is ordering a beer and they have a million questions. It's like they're ordering a car or something. I mean, what are the questions people should ask, and what do you need to know about a good beer, and how much individual is it, you know, individual taste and stuff like that?
So much of it is about individual taste. So think about things that you like when you are talking about a beer, things that you like to eat, things that you like to drink. You don't have to know anything about beer. And we have some of the finest bartenders here in Chicago that will step you through beers in a completely unintimidating fashion. So you may say what type of wine you like. So if you like a Riesling or you like something a little bit sweeter and lighter, they may steer you towards a lager or a summertime ale. If you like something really dark and heavy, you may say, I drink my coffee black and I have it all day long. They may turn you on to a Russian Imperial Stout. So really understanding the flavors that you like and not how they relate to beer is what you bring to the equation. And then a top quality bartender will be able to match the beer that's on their beer list with that. The other thing is, if you do know there are certain styles or certain brands of beer that you like, walk in there, and if they don't carry it, ask to see what is similar, what's going to have similar characteristics.
Now tell us some of the beers. What are we drinking right now? What do we have here?
Well, we're starting off with a brewery that's out of Itasca, and it's Church Street Brewing. And the beer is Hock von Himmel Hefeweizen.
What does that mean?
Well, it actually started off, and I can't remember what the first name was, but another brewery had the same name. So they said, okay, we've got the same name beer. Can you change it? So they did, to Heretic Hefeweizen. Then they got contacted by another brewery that said, hey, we've got the same beer. So they had to change it. So that this time they went with Hock von Himmel Hefeweizen because they said nobody is going to have that name. And so that's, I can't, something in heaven is what it means.
Okay.
And Hefeweizen is a wheat beer. So these are going to taste a little bit more sour. If you take a look at the beer, it's somewhat cloudy. You're also going to have wild yeast in here. This is a style of beer that you might put a piece of citrus fruit into.
Yeah, right.
So go ahead and give it a little sip. Tell us what you think about it.
Yeah. Well, it does remind me a little bit of a Blue Moon, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the Blue Moon style of beer. Yeah. These are often brewed with spices such as coriander, Birds of Paradise, which is related in flavor to black peppercorns, are oftentimes put in there as well. Sometimes you can get more exotic beers where they're going to be putting in flavors such is Five Rabbit does a great hefeweizen where they put in some lemongrass and they also put in papaya and just really dynamite. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the older, as I'm aging gracefully, I notice I'm not drinking as much as I used to. But does wheat beer give you, does that make, give you hangovers and stuff? I mean, sometimes I'll go out and have two blue moons and I feel it the next day. Is that just me or?
You know, I haven't been able to drink the same since I've been about 25. So it could just be. Yeah.
I just wonder if the wheat does anything.
You know.
It could be that it's unfiltered or it's maybe a little sweeter.
Absolutely. Mm. It could be the strains of yeast. I mean, there's so many different components to the beer, and you may have some allergies or sensitivities that really kick into the hangover. Thing is, hydrate.
What do you think of this, Dan, of the first round here?
I like it. I mean, from an unsophisticated beer drinker. You know, like I like a nice craft brew, but I couldn't tell you why. You know, it just kind of hits me right in the right place in the taste buds. But looking at the Church Street website here, my question is, this is kind of under the category of seasonal beers, and this falls. You know, this one is in season. It says May to July. Is that kind of determined by, you know, the freshness and availability of ingredients or, you know, where you're getting your hops and stuff from?
Yeah, and they get, Church Street gets actually gets their hops from Belgium and from Germany, from whatever style of beer that they are making, that's where they get the hops from. So, yes, it's absolutely based on the availability of the ingredients, why it's seasonal.
And also, this is a lighter beer, so it has a lighter flavor, and that pairs nicer with our summertime dishes. So this is actually something you could sit down, you could have a nice pasta dish, you could have some grilled fish. And so oftentimes the seasonality of beers is not just based on the ingredients, but how they pair with foods that we're eating during different seasons, how heavy or how light they are.
Will food be served next Saturday at this event?
AJ Hudson's sells food, and we encourage everybody to eat some because it's delicious. And also it's, you know, a really good idea if you are drinking through 26 beers to order food. We do not serve beer, but the menus are there and the service staff is excellent. So they'll bring around food and we can make suggestions on the menu of what's going to pair with like the next section of beers.
Are reservations needed for this or should people just show up?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How do you make a reservation?
Alphabeer.com. Okay. And you purchase tickets ahead of time. The event is $50. Or we have two tables of six left for $250. So if you can find five friends and you can go free. And we've got two of those tables left. And then we have just individual tickets left. But that's at alphabeer.com.
Dan mentioned craft beer. And even that, I get confused. I mean, I've heard like craft beer being something that's independently owned. How do you define craft beer today? What is craft beer?
It's just the volume of beer that's produced by the brewery. And I'll be honest, I don't know what that threshold is. But it's, if you're looking at some producers that are brewing millions of gallons of beer, that's going to be what differentiates a craft brewer from a mass brewer.
You started Alpha Beer in January 2012?
No, it actually started in 2009, I believe. Yeah.
Okay.
November 2009 was the first one.
Tasted more than 200 beers. I've read that.
I've had over 300.
Over 300?
Jill's had over 200 because she's been with me for that long.
Wow. And believe it or not, I can talk and taste.
She can.
But there is no shame in spitting beer. So we do encourage everybody to stay nice and sober. So if they feel like they're getting out of bounds, you can taste beer just like you can taste wine without swallowing it and without getting a buzz even.
How much has the whole industry just changed since you guys started this?
Oh my gosh.
I mean, and how much is it growing around Chicago?
It's phenomenal. I mean, just the number of breweries that are popping up, it seems like on a weekly basis. I mean, the first couple of Alpha beers are primarily international beers because it was much easier to populate the list through international beers. And then I think it was around Alpha Beer 7, that's when we did in pretty much all Chicago and very close to Midwest. And I think that's when I got involved. By that time, and that was around 2012, that's when all the local craft beer scene pretty much exploded. And so we had our pick of the litter, basically.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We're going to have a couple more beers, and I want to talk to some of the special guests who are going to be there, right? Okay, don't go away. More Nocturnal Journal after this. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal, and we're talking about women and beer and Alpha Beer 14 at A.J. Hudson's Public House, June 27th at 6 o'clock. Tell us about just the growth of women in the beer industry, and who are some of the special guests going to be next Saturday night?
That's also... there used to be the stereotype that women would want the lighter beers, or they if they drank beer at all. That's no longer the case. Now women are all over the beer industry. And some of our special guests include Claudia Gendron. She is the brewmaster for Temperance out of Evanston. And in fact, last year she won a silver medal for her Gatecrasher IPA at the Great American Beer Festival in Denver. So that was a huge accomplishment for her. And she actually used to be a marine biologist and was a homebrewer with her grandfather.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow.
You find a lot of scientists get into beer.
Yeah. Yes.
Because it is very technical.
Yep. Yeah. And Church Street Brewing, Lisa Greger will be there. She and her husband own Church Street. And her husband, Joe, who is the brewer, was a he's a chemical engineer. So, yeah, it's very technical. And to be able to replicate those recipes requires a lot of exactness. So, but yet Lisa will be there. She does everything but brewing. And so that's another aspect of what we're going to be showing people at the event, is that you don't have to just be a brewer. You can be in the sales aspect. You can be in the marketing aspect. Like Jennifer Bruckner from Brooklyn Brewery will be there as well.
And yes, so will they talk and they'll talk?
Yes. They will each introduce the beers that they represent. So Claudia will talk about Quotidian, which I was so grateful that she actually created a Q beer, because that's really hard to find.
We're going to have we're going to run out of time to drink all these beers, but we'd like to do maybe one more go-to beer. But is there a regional, I mean, like, you know, Chicago's known for deep dish pizza, and there's a certain regional food thing. Is there a regional beer thing? Is Chicago known for a certain style of beer?
I would say a tip
besides
to her.
Old style.
I mean, Chicago is just in general a beer drinking town, period. Full stop. By the population that came here from Europe, they all brought their beer brewing traditions with them. And so we have a lot of pilsners and lagers, but really, as the tastes of the United States have changed, we're getting in some more interesting craft ales. We're getting in some IPAs. You know, Goose Island really tipped off this whole explosion. Unfortunately, you know, Prohibition knocked out a lot of these historical beer types that I think where we would have had a more rooted beer culture that was specific to the immigrants that came here. But everybody across the United States had a clean slate after that. And so when massive beer brewing came back after World War II, that's when all of the styles were introduced universally across the United States. So Chicago doesn't really have a style of beer we're known for.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to try one more here and talk about that. What one do you recommend here?
I think we should try Claudia's, the Quotidian.
Okay. Now, how would you...
I'm sorry.
Okay.
We're going to try
the Brooklyn
beer. It all tastes the same.
Yeah, dirty little secret. It all tastes the same.
Is there something wrong with me, too? You know, I like beer out of a bottle. That's not a purist thing to do, is it? I mean, when I go to a bar, I just like drinking it out of a bottle.
You know what?
Most people don't do that.
It really is how you enjoy it. Yeah. The only issue with drinking from a bottle or from a can is that you are closing in some of those aromas. So I love to put beer in any sort of open vessel, because beer drinking, like any other aspect of drinking, is so involved with the sense of smell.
Yeah.
So this is a great beer that we're trying here. It's from Brooklyn Brewery. And
thank you, Julia.
It's Sriracha Ace. And what's interesting about this is it's a farmhouse ale, which is a very on-trend type of beer right now. So you use wild farmhouse yeast. And how this beer style started is at the end of the harvest season, all of the farmers would take their excess grain, whatever it was, whatever crazy mix they had, and they'd make it into beer. So from year to year, this is going to change. And because we've got wild yeast here, you're going to get some of those like tart, sour flavors. This pairs with food as well as any wine does. And this one has a special type of hops that were developed in the 1970s in Japan called the Sriracha hop. And that's why the beer has the name Sriracha Ace. It has flavors of lemongrass in here, which pairs particularly well. Yeah, this is a great beer if you think you don't like beer. So if you're a wine drinker and you're looking to cross over, it's a fantastic place to start. And this pairs with so many wonderful summertime foods. So you can have this with your grilled barbecue chicken. You can have it with burgers. You can have it with fish.
Do you like it on its own? Dan Long, have you had this yet? Dan?
Yeah, I like it. It seems... like, I got the same impression that it's pretty flexible as far as, like, food pairings go. You know, it's light enough, and, yeah, I like it.
We have that Nocturnal Journal barbecue. We'll have to serve this. It's like, this is good. Now, you said more women are involved in the industry. Are more women drinking beer in bars and stuff? Or?
You know, Alpha Beer, Teresa can probably speak from the beginning, but since I've been involved, I've seen a steady increase in the number of women who attend. And now I would say we're close to 50-50. It used to be a great place if you were a woman to meet a guy because it was all dudes. Yeah. But I would say if you're a guy, it's a great place to meet women.
Yeah, it is about 50-50 women now. Yeah. Has been the last couple times.
And so you'll be serving 26?
26, yes. 2 to 3 ounce tastings for each letter. And just like Jill's been speaking about the beers tonight, that's what she does at the event. Or the special guests will be speaking about their beers, too. So it's not just a tasting. It's also a learning experience. And in addition to the verbal notes, we also have notes on all the screens. AJ Hudson's has, you know, how many screens they have? I don't know. Like 25 screens. And all the notes are broadcast on the screens, too.
Well, that's a great event. Yeah, that'll be great. So, well, thank you for coming in. It's been really, really good. I really enjoyed this last beer we had. So good luck. And again, you can make reservations at
alphabeer.com.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for everybody coming in on Nocturnal Journal tonight. And we'll be back next week with some more live music.